I suppose, between your character and what people see. And some of the characters in the book, like Boy and like the Whitmans, find a way to project an image and then move sort of silently and independently beneath the surface of that image without anyone bothering them, which is their kind of priority, that they just not be bothered, that they be left alone. And I identify with that very much. I have always felt, oh, just leave me alone. All I've wanted to do is read.
and write, obviously.
Right, writing not always, actually. Reading definitely most of all, and it's always felt as if things get in the way.
Well, tell us a little about your choice to retell Snow White from the perspective of the stepmother, the wicked stepmother in the original version, and how you began with that, and what that choice means for the novel.
It was a combination of things. I think a lot about alliance and about bonds between women and how they're not necessarily the same as the bond between a woman and a man. I think there are some women, like I'm thinking of Ruth and Naomi in the Old Testament, who will just follow each other, whither thou goest, I will go. And that kind of absolute solidarity, I suppose, can lead you into the most bitter disappointment possible, especially between an older woman and a younger woman, and the ways in which they look at each other, the older woman looking at the younger woman as this kind of bringer of potential, and the younger woman looking at the older woman as, in a way, her future self. And there were kind of all of these identifications that generationally we can transfer onto each other. And then there's just this kind of great clash. So I wanted to look into that dynamic. I think it can be specifically a stepmother-stepdaughter's dynamic, at least in fairy tales.
And you found Snow White in the original tale to be more terrifying than the wicked stepmother. And then I read that you, in the process of writing the book, actually found yourself feeling sorry for the Snow White character that you created. How did that happen? And what was terrifying about the original Snow White when you read the fable?
She's so passive that it seems like the calm before a very great storm. So many things happen to her, and she just sort of meekly accepts them, and then she sort of lies down into death and is woken up by this prince. And yes, you wonder. But in Anne Sexton's Transformations, which is one of those retellings that actually really changed the way that I saw the story, you see that in a way it's as if one psyche is separated into two. So you have the wicked stepmother who is the active one and who suffers the most horrific punishment, while Snow White kind of sits there watching with blinking her eyes like a doll. And that kind of gives you chills.
And yet in the process of characterizing her in the novel, you found yourself having some empathy for her scenario.
She's put in an awful position within her family. She has all these expectations on her that she can't possibly live up to. And also, I'm not sure, I don't know, I think that Boy felt for her. And it's an interesting thing about Boy, because as I was writing her, she would never admit to caring about hardly anybody, but actually she cares about lots of people. She remembers lots of details from the lives of friends or people that she's only even met once, and this kind of attention is something that she passes on to her daughter, who then has this kind of journalistic quest to record everything. So I think that it was Boy's impulse to try and find the real Snow that uncovers the real Snow a little bit, and that makes her come to life.
We're talking today to author Helen Oyeyemi about her fifth and latest novel, Boy, Snow, Bird. Helen, do you want to read a little bit from the novel for us?
Yes, I'll just read a bit from the very first chapter. Nobody ever warned me about mirrors. So for many years I was fond of them and believed them to be trustworthy. I'd hide myself away inside them, setting two mirrors up to face each other, so that when I stood between them, I was infinitely reflected in either direction. many, many me's. When I stood on tiptoe, we all stood on tiptoe, trying to see the first of us and the last. The effect was dizzying, a vast pulse, not quite alive, more like the working of an automaton. I felt the reflection at my shoulder like a touch. I was on the most familiar terms with her, same as any other junior dope too lonely to be selective about the company she keeps. Mirror showed me that I was a girl with a white blonde pigtail hanging down over one shoulder, eyebrows and lashes the same colour, still near black eyes, and one of those faces some people call harsh and others call fine-boned. It was not unusual for me to fix a scarf around my head and spend an afternoon pretending that I was a nun from another century. My forehead was high enough. And my complexion is unpredictable. Goes from near bloodless to scalded and back again, all without my permission. There are still days when I can only work out whether or not I'm upset by looking at my face.
Do you do your own audiobooks? Because if you don't, you really should.
No, thank you. It's very flattering. I'm actually really excited about the audiobook for this because they've got two actresses. One for boy and one for bird, because those are the two main voices in the book.
And have you heard it?
They sent me a sample of the actress who read bird, and it was just spot on. So.
Oh, that's great.
I think it's going to be good.
Well, maybe for your next book. So I have a question I wanted to ask you about the issue of spoilers and narratives, and they're partly because I'm sort of the ongoing joke in my book club, because I'm always the one who's allergic to having the narrative spoiled. And this book has a lot of secrets in it, mm-hmm. and yet some of the secrets are exposed in interviews and also on the back of the book, which I always avoid when I read books. So I was curious what your relationship to that is, and how much you want to push into some of the mysteries that are contained in the book in our discussion.
I think you can't really win with spoilers. In the UK, I didn't talk about plot at all much. I mostly gave a general overview, because the jacket copy on the UK just kind of says that the book is about a mysterious connection between three women, which makes it sound a little bit on the boring side, actually. Like, if I was picking up myself, I'd be like, but I can totally understand why they did that, because the experience for a reader in the UK will be more like, what? And then what? Which I actually really appreciate, because as I was writing from Inside Boy, that's what I was going through. But with the US, I think maybe there's this sort of surplus of fairy tale retellings. Not that I'm complaining, I love all fairy tale retellings, but there's a need to say how this fairy tale retelling is different from other ones. And so highlighting that it is about race, that is partially about race, is important, I think. But for me, when I'm reading a book, personally, I don't mind plot spoilers.
You don't mind them?
No, I don't, because I tend to read for a way of seeing more than anything else. So I'm trying to get to know a character, and if I know what happens to them beforehand,
it
doesn't make much
deal.
Of a difference.
So you'd be one of those people laughing at me in my book club.
Yes, I think so.
So let's talk a little bit about the interrogation of race in Boy Snowbird. One of the issues that it goes into is the issue of, or the phenomenon of passing, of light-skinned African-Americans passing as white, and mm-hmm. the legacy that has, the ghost families that it creates, mm-hmm. as they essentially disinherit potentially parts of their family in order to pass as white. I was interested to learn that in reading some of your interviews, that is an American phenomenon and not one that happens in Europe. Can you talk a little bit about that, for instance?
I'm not sure why. I think it might just be because in some ways there was less to gain from passing in Europe. I mean, there were actually, in parts of the country at the time that the book is set, there were actually laws that dictated where black people could sit and eat and go to school. And the Whitmans kind of partly enjoy, but are partly really grieved by making a mockery of these laws and just passing fluidly between these different parts of existence, almost, and just seeing how artificial the whole construct of it was. But something that I read, which kind of fed into what I ended up writing was a short story by Hisayo Yamamoto, who's a Japanese-American writer, and she writes about traveling through the South during the early 50s, I think, and struggling to decide whether she should go into the coloured bathroom or the one for whites. And eventually she sort of talked herself into this state where she decided that she should go into the whites bathroom. And she saw a cleaning lady, a coloured cleaning lady in there, who looked at her just so expressionlessly that the gaze stayed with her for days. And so that was something to do with a failure of solidarity, which fed into what I ended up writing.
And so it really makes the setting and the time period crucial to this book. It's hard to imagine this book not taking place in America and not taking place in that pivot point in the 1950s and 1960s in America.
Yeah, I think it just had to be. And I was wary of setting it actually in the South. I thought it was necessary to have a degree of distance to some extent, but also to show how pervasive those ways of thinking could be.
And how much do you rely on research and versus imaginative capacities when creating the 1950s America when you're British, for instance?
It was a mix of things. I have a sort of residual knowledge of 50s and 60s American pop culture just because it's sort of my favorite personal zone to be in. So I'm always playing doo-wop songs and etc. And yeah, comparing and contrasting that to what I know of America from reading about, say, the Black Panthers, the autobiography of Malcolm X, was a kind of jolt. There's a jolt that happens when you realise that you have these housewives serving up apple pies, and then there are horrific lynchings going on, and at the same time, and I actually think that some of Gwendolyn Brooks's poetry captures the uncanniness of that. I read a poem of hers about the woman who sort of instigated the murder of Emmett Till that really stuck with me, and how this woman is sort of wondering, like, on some subconscious level, she was worth all of that.
That sounds like you probably know more about the time period than most Americans.
Oh, the Emmett Till murder, I couldn't sleep or believe it for a long time after I read it. It was,
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to Helen Oyeyemi about her latest book, Boy Snowbird. Another thing I noticed in the book is while the novel's really full of a lot of women and strong female characters, there's a real absence of mothers. And that juxtaposition was really fascinating to me. And was that something that you set out to do or discovered that you had done?
I'm not quite sure. I think it's more something that I discovered I had done. Although when I first began the book, a writer friend said to me that one of the most fun things about a wicked stepmother is when it's impossible to determine her origin. And so I kind of thought, perhaps on some level, I thought that motherlessness was one way of coming at this. So a way of saying there is no precedent for this kind of woman that I'm presenting you with.
And Boy, who is the name of the wicked stepmother in this story, she has a childhood love. But she chooses to marry, it seems, for more practical and sober reasons than going for the intoxication of the feeling she has for this childhood love. But it's never fully explained why she makes that choice. And I was curious what your thoughts were on what drew her into this life. Was it her captivation with Snow, who would become her stepdaughter, that drew her to her future husband?
Partly. I mean, I guess if Boy was here right now and we asked her, she would say that she married for peace of mind.
Interesting.
But because her childhood love made a great mistake of telling her that she was beautiful in front of her father, which kind of destroyed anything that they could possibly have had because of the consequences of that. She needs not to be bothered. She needs people not to tell her things about herself. She just wants to be herself.
And does that go back to the mirror theme of being seen by her father, being told that she's beautiful, the sort of reflecting back on what she appears to be?
That's exactly it. She wants to completely sidestep all reflections, even the ones that are meant as loving ones, which turn bitter for her. But on another level, I think with Boy, she has this understanding of herself as bad, but she also has this understanding of her badness as useful. So I think with Snow and the Whitmans, she sees that there is some trouble, some necessary trouble that she has to create within that family, and so she does.
So stepping back on and looking more generally at the enterprise of your five books and your retelling of fairy tales, can you talk a little bit about what it is about fairy tales that attracts you and attracts you enough to return to frequently?
I'm still not sure. I think there's something in the logic of them, maybe. The kind of very strange, childlike stroke logic that comes upon you when you're not feeling very well, that you can unpick and find. Maybe a lot of our most primal, maybe a lot of our emotions and instincts, the things that drive us, the things that we fear, the remedies for all our ills, our psychological ills anyway. And you take these things and you can shift them around to all sorts of different times and places, and somehow they still work. It's been fun climbing around inside that.
And when you were writing White Is for Witching, you were reading Shirley Jackson at the time, a specific book by her, The Haunting of Hill House.
Yeah.
Is there a book that you were reading or books that you were reading for Boy Snowbird that informed some of its telling?
Not really. I was reading so much, but nothing that really fed into Boy Snowbird. I think the things I was reading are going to feed into the next book, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about
it? I can't.
You can't tell us even a little?
You'll have to wait and give it a shot.
And then what about non-literary influences on this book? You'd mentioned with Mr. Fox that there was a lot of film noir element to it. Was there any film or music or anything that you can think of that went into Boy Snowbird as you wrote it?
Well, with Boy Novak, that's a nod to Kim Novak, who I always think of as the most deeply sad blonde in films. I would always watch her, and the depths in her eyes were mesmerizing in a way, and I just always wanted her to be okay and to sort of find a way out. Kind of giving Boy her surname and making sure that she got out and was safe. That was kind of my nod to Kim Novak. Lots of the characters I could easily think of a sort of classic Hollywood film analogue for them, actually.
That's interesting.
So, yeah.
Well, at the same time, you really make these choices that keep people from feeling totally at ease in a good way. It creates an eeriness or an uncanniness, the main character being named Boy, but being a woman, black people passing as white people, the mirror not being honest. It's very unsettling in a pleasurably unsettling way, I think, the atmosphere that you create.
I think, again, it feeds into the time and just the strangeness of that time. Just before great changes, when things are still sort of transforming and shifting from one state to another.
Yeah, the metamorphosis.
Yeah.
When I first heard about you, when I had a couple of years ago, I had China Mieville on, and he was raving about White Is for Witching.
He's the loveliest.
And he said, the way he described it was, I love what Helen Oyemi's doing in this book, but I cannot understand how she's doing it. And I love that I can't understand how she's doing it. Like the mechanics, you'd created a spell, so he couldn't see the magic of how you created it. And I was curious if there were authors like that for you, that you go to not to learn how to write necessarily, but to be mystified by how they write and inspired by how they write.
Huh. Kelly Link is definitely one. No idea how. Shirley Jackson, of course.
Shirley Jackson, yeah.
I'm really, really, really delighted by somebody who is also on the Grantor list with me, Jenny Fagan, who wrote The Panopticon, which the heroine is this orphan who is, I don't really know how to explain it. She's sort of, her psyche is gigantic and so powerful that she scares her own hallucinations. So at one point, she hallucinates some faces coming out of the wall, and she says to them, "Can I help you?" And they sort of recede back into the wall immediately. And that is the kind of girl that she is. She'll wear lipstick and pillbox hats, but be ready to sort of jump into a brawl at the slightest moment's notice. So yeah, Jenny Fagan is one who captures a kind of reckless girlhood, and that I love. Who else?
And what about writers that you find a familiar resonance with? Ones that you do go to for because they feel like kindred spirits.
There's Barbara Cummins, who I think has been influencing me more and more ever since I first read her, which was shortly before writing Mr. Fox. She has this candid style that I like, and that I think I sometimes use, a kind of a frankness that is slightly frightening, because you think, well, what is she going to say next? Because she seems like she might actually tell you the truth, and you might not want to hear it.
Oh, that sounds delightful.
So I love Barbara Cummins. Who else? I've started reading an Argentinian early 20th century writer called Silvina Ocampo, who writes a lot about dreams, amoral children, intensely amoral children, actually, and a kind of circularity of time that I recognize.
Well, I know you don't want to talk about your next project, though it sounds like it's germinating right now. But can you tell us a little bit about how, having written Boy Snowbird, how that potentially informs the choices you're making in your next project, that you want to do with something that's more a certain way or less a certain way based on what you've just finished?
I know that I'll be taking a break from fairy tales. Other than that, I think it's going to be a completely different thing. I think the attitude will be the same. I think that's the sort of one constant between all my books, that there's a certain attitude. So I think that will be the same, but I don't think I will work so much on tropes.
Well, I really look forward to it. It was great having you on Between the Covers today, Helen.
Thanks so much.
We are talking today with Helen Oyeyemi, the author of Boy Snow Bird. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the Worldbeat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Hello and welcome to the film show on KBOO. I'm S.W. Conser.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Today we'll be telling you about some up-and-coming young filmmakers in Oregon. Thomas Philipson is joining us in the studio. He is the regional coordinator for the Student Academy Awards.
And we'll be hearing from about the upcoming Filmed by Bike Festival from the filmmaker in the spotlight, Andy Chandler, whose comedy videos have become a big hit on YouTube.
But first, Conch has a guest on the phone, and she's the subject of a new documentary that was filmed here in Portland.
All right. So we are on the line with Vivian Haar down in California, and she'll be coming to Portland on April 9th for a premiere of the film Make a Stand at the Hollywood Theater. Vivian, thank you so much for joining us here on the film show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to get a little bit of background about this film. It's called Make a Stand, and this is based on the fact that you started a lemonade stand a couple of years ago. You were 8 years old at the time, and what was the cause for which you were raising money?
Slavery. I wanted to end child slavery in my lifetime. Well, actually, but now I have a new goal of ending child slavery by the time I'm 20, and I'm 10 now, so.
Wow. Well, you know, this is an interesting issue that's come up recently. I know that, well, here on our station, KBOO, we've been talking about human trafficking and child slavery for some years now, but this has become a mainstream issue just in the past year that I've noticed, and I think you may be partially to be credited for this.
Thank you.
So how did you first hear about the issue of child slavery?
Well, my parents were in a gallery in Sonoma, and they saw this photo of two boys in slavery, and they brought it home to me, and I said, we have to help these kids, and they said, okay. So that's what we did.
Well, it's strange. A lot of people will think that slavery was outlawed many, many years ago, before you or I were born. And how is it still allowed to function in the world today? How is that possible?
It's not. It's not allowed. It's actually illegal. But they do it anyway.
So you raised $100,000 with your lemonade stand, and that's pretty amazing, but mostly you got a lot of attention. What were some of the things that started happening when your lemonade stand geared up for business?
Well, it was really amazing to see all these people getting inspired, and yeah.
And you ended up giving a TEDx talk about the project that you've been working on. That's been inspiring a lot of people, too.
Yeah, that was pretty cool, successful. And yeah, I did it at Square headquarters, and it was really, really fun.
So tell me about the project that that developed out of that, and which direction it's going in right now. I know you're working with a whole bunch of different people.
Mm-hmm. So the direction that it's going in is a very good direction, because we have our lemonade at Square and Twitter and Microsoft and all those places like that. So, yeah, and we are really happy that it's actually working.
And this is your recipe for lemonade, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's great. And tell us a little bit about the movie. It's coming to Portland. It'll be at the Hollywood Theater here on April 9th, and it's called Stand With Me. And so you're kind of the star of this. Tell us a little bit about what to expect when we see the movie.
Okay, well, it's really sweet. It's really nice. It's not scary at all. And actually, the movie was made in Portland. So, yeah.
So will you be in Portland on April 9th to introduce the movie?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I will.
And you'll be answering questions from the audience?
Yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing you then. So the movie is called Stand With Me, and it'll be playing at 7:30 p.m. on April 9th at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Where can people find out more about this movie and about this project, Make a Stand?
Mm-hmm. And the website for it is StandWithMeMovie.com, and I'd like to thank Still Motion for making the movie. Oh, and I have one more thing to say.
That sure.
On the website, you can see the trailer and buy the tickets, and our website is MakeAStand.com.
Thank you, Vivian, for being our guest today.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the film show on KBOO. I'm S.W. Conser. We'll be joined a little later in the show by Andy Chandler, who will be talking about the Filmed by Bike Festival. But first, here's Jen with our guest in the studio.
Thanks, Conch. And we do have a pair of tickets to give away to the Portland premiere of Stand With Me. If you are the lucky third caller to the front desk here at KBOO, your name will be at the door on April 9th at the Hollywood Theater. The number to call is 503-231-8032. Again, the third caller at 503-231-8032. 8032 gets a pair of tickets to see Stand With Me on April 9th. And Vivian Haar, the subject of the film, will be in attendance to answer questions. Now I'm joined by the Northwest Film Center's Thomas Phillipson, who is the longstanding regional coordinator of the Student Academy Awards. He'll be presiding over the Regional One or Western U.S. Finals at the Northwest Film Center on April 23rd at 6 p.m. Narrative, documentary, animated, and experimental works by film students from regional schools will be juried and narrowed down for advancements to the National Finals in Los Angeles. Thank you for joining us and welcome to the film show, Thomas.
Thanks for inviting me, Jen.
So before we get to the regional